how to keep insurers in insurance exchanges, and whether data-driven management can make government act more like a startup. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood in All Week for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, March 27th. Thank you for joining us. We begin today with this question, what now? That's what we're all asking after House Republicans last week failed to pass a repeal and replacement for the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Over the weekend, President Trump predicted that the ACA will, quote, explode. One way that could happen is if more insurers drop out of state and federal exchanges in 2018. They're worried that they will take a bath insuring sick and expensive customers, as some of them already have, and so they're looking to Congress and the Trump administration for help. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY, Dan Gorenstein looks at what insurers need to stay in the program.
Hello, heartache. Insurance consultant Robert Leshefsky says companies are definitely singing the blues.
Why would any executive in their right mind want to participate and shovel more capital into a business that the stated policy of this administration is to just let it collapse?
More than 11 million Americans bought insurance last year on the federal or state exchanges. Some of the largest national insurers abandoned this market last year, saying they were bleeding money. The fewer the insurers, the higher prices consumers face. So what do the Blue Cross plans and others need to stick around?
The biggest thing insurers want to hear right now is what will happen to the cost-sharing subsidy payments.
That's the Kaiser Family Foundation's Larry Levitt. Under Obamacare, some Americans are eligible for help with not only premiums, but also out-of-pocket costs, like deductibles. Those are worth an estimated $9 billion to insurers. But that money is at risk after Congress sued the Obama administration for executive overreach in 2014. Now, if President Donald Trump agrees with Congress, that money disappears, making it really hard for insurers to sell policies on the exchanges.
If he wants to spike Obamacare, he could do it immediately with the stroke of a pen. There's no question.
University of Michigan law professor Nick Bagley says this poses the single greatest threat to stability for insurers next year and jeopardizes coverage potentially for millions. In the next few weeks, jittery insurers want some signal from the president. Is he content letting Obamacare actually explode, or does he intend to deliver on his promise of insurance for all? I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Also in Washington today, President Trump is asking his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to head up a new White House Office of American Innovation. This will be a new department with the goal of using technology and data to make government run more like a fast-moving business. Now, it should be said that Donald Trump is far from the first president to try this concept. Presidents Bush and Obama also had similar initiatives. But it would also be fair to say that this idea of data-driven management has been slow to catch on inside the Beltway. And as we keep coming back to, business and government are just kind of different. Marketplace's Adam Allington has more.
Okay, so yes, most government agencies aren't what you would call a hotbed of innovation, but that's not to say it hasn't taken a cue from business with respect to database management.
The way that I think it's improved government functioning is that it's gotten people who normally their job is not to talk to each other to talk to each other.
Carter Hughley is director of analytics at the Center for Government Excellence at Johns Hopkins. While some agencies have been slow to adapt, he says data and analytics have actually led to big improvements in everything from public health to law enforcement.
Crime reduction, you've seen cost savings, you've seen service quality improvements on the timely resolution of 311 calls and pothole repair, things like that.
But Vanderbilt political science professor David Lewis says there are some key differences between the goal of a business and that of a government agency.
The difficulty with government as opposed to the private sector is that many things that government does can't be measured easily. They're hard to quantify or analyze with data.
For instance, Lewis says it would be difficult to say, put a metric on how effective the State Department has been at promoting democracy.
And so the ability to use data in government activities is sometimes limited by the fact that government just is different. It's really hard to observe outcomes.
Lewis also points out that unlike the private sector, government has often underspent on both data collection and in hiring the kinds of people who can do the data analysis. So if Kushner can lobby for change on that front, he says it could be another step in the right direction. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a bloody start to Monday trading, but a calmer finish. We'll have all the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. One thing got repealed on the Hill last week. The U.S. Senate quietly voted to roll back the Federal Communications Commission's broadband privacy rules. These rules would have given consumers the power to choose how to share personal data when it gets collected by internet service providers, like, for example, data about the websites that you visit. Now, tomorrow, the bill goes to the House for a vote. If it passes, President Trump is expected to sign it. But for many consumers, they're just finding out that this history was up for sale in the first place. Dallas Harris is a policy fellow for Public Knowledge. Dallas, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you today?
Very well. So tell me, if you would, what we can expect from this vote in the House and what they're voting on in terms of broadband privacy.
Sure. Well, unfortunately, I am expecting the CRA of the broadband privacy rules to pass the House tomorrow. This is really a sign that industry, particularly large telecom companies and internet service providers, have a much louder voice in Washington than consumers do. Really, these rules were designed to protect consumers, give them more control over their information, and the Senate and Congress has decided to make it easier for internet service providers to make a buck.
Yeah, so tell me how they would make a buck. I think, you know, for people who aren't familiar with this issue, what is at stake here? What kind of information?
Sure. Internet service providers collect all types of information about you, the websites that you visit, how long you're online, when you're online, how long you're on particular websites. And essentially, what's at stake for consumers is they are about to become the product for internet service providers. They're no longer just customers. They're also something now, a profile that internet service providers can sell in order to make additional dollars.
And so the rules, is this correct interpretation? The rules that were going to go into place had not yet already, right? Is this information already being sold?
So you're correct. These rules were given a little bit of time to be put into place for internet service providers to get together whatever mechanisms they need to put in place to comply with the rules. And without them, yes, internet service providers are free to sell all kinds of information about you without getting your consent first.
So if this bill is to pass, it essentially preserves a status quo, or do you expect that ISPs will then build new money-making products on top of this data?
Well, they sure will be free to do so. I can't speak to every practice or every business that they were involved in before the rules, but it's clear now that internet service providers will be able to access and use your information in all kinds of ways that they would not have been able to if the rules would have stayed in place.
What do they want to use the data for? Do you have any idea?
Sure. They want to be the new advertising kings on the block. Essentially, they feel like edge providers like Google and Facebook, they have the advertising market cornered. And internet service providers, frankly, are a bit jealous of their capabilities in that space and also then want to be players on the advertising block, right? They want to be the new Mad Men.
And quickly, I know that some of these ISPs had argued that your browsing history is not that sensitive. What kind of information might they be getting from you?
All kinds of information. Let me just throw out a couple of things. Your political affiliation, based upon the top-level domain information of websites you visit. Your sexual orientation, where you like to shop. Your financial status, right? Race, mm-hmm. Gender. They can figure out all of these different things based upon the information that they collect and use.
That's Dallas Harris, Policy Fellow for Public Knowledge. Dallas, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up.
If you were to go to, say, a large apparel store and you wanted to try 20 or 30 different outfits, that's a time-consuming thing.
Plus, you get all sweaty. Shopping is just way too hard. But before that story, let's do the numbers. It was a bumpy ride on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shed 45 points, 0.2% to close at 20,550. The NASDAQ gained 11 points, 0.2% to finish at 5840. And the S&P 500 fell 2 points, 0.1% to close at 2341. Viacom has named a new chairman and chief executive officer. On that news, the media powerhouse showed up 2.9%. Elsewhere in entertainment communications, Comcast lost 0.7%, and Discovery gained 0.3%. Amazon gained 0.1%, although today, technical problems forced the online retailer to put the brakes on its first cashierless store in Seattle, which was set to open to the public this month. Overstock.com, headquartered in Midvale, Utah, racked up 0.8%, and Walmart gained less than 0.1%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.37%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
If you want to get smarter about all the things we talk about on this program every single day,
technology, the economy, pop culture, politics, check out our podcast, Make Me Smart.
Molly Wood is my co-host.
Or maybe Kai Rizdahl is my co-host.
I don't know. Maybe. We've got new episodes every week.
And we have live Facebook videos and all kinds of other great stuff for you.
Find us at marketplace.org/makemesmart or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts.
And please follow us on Twitter for more. I am at Molly Wood.
And I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Check it out.
You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Now for a story on what is arguably the least popular technology in the world, printers. Specifically printer cartridges, which really only ever run out when you need that ink the most. And then there is that thorny question. Should you buy a name brand replacement at an insanely high price or go with one of those cheaper cartridges that's been refilled? Well, that decision may soon be made for you because, believe it or not, printer cartridges made it to the Supreme Court. SCOTUS last week heard arguments in Impression Products versus Lexmark International. Lexmark makes printers and cartridges and says those cartridges are protected and cannot be resold. Impression Products refills cartridges and disagrees. And Marketplace's Sally Herships has more on why this seemingly small lawsuit could affect the resale of everything from computers to smartphones to cars.
Most people assume when they buy a product, say, like a printer cartridge, they can do whatever they want with it. That's got a legal name, patent exhaustion.
You can use it as a doorstop. You can use it in a printer.
And when they're done, they can resell it. Henry Huang, a patent lawyer with the law firm Ropes & Gray, says there's a problem. Companies that try to protect their patents by putting restrictions on their sales, like Lexmark. It says when you buy one of its cartridges, you're only allowed to use it once, and you can't refill it or even give it away.
I guess in a nutshell, the real issue is whether or not people who own patents can restrict what people do with their products after they're sold.
John Allison teaches law at the University of Texas. He's one of a long list of academics who wrote a brief to share his opinion on the case with the Supreme Court. He says Lexmark's argument is that when you buy one of its printer cartridges, the title of ownership isn't really transferred to you.
It looks like a duck and quacks like a duck and waddles like a duck and so forth, but Lexmark is trying to say that it's really not a duck.
Allison says the implications of the case could be far-reaching.
That could potentially be done with any product that even has a patented component in it.
Anything from a washing machine to a car to a cell phone. Lexmark says it can't comment on pending litigation. The Supreme Court will get final say. A decision is expected by June or July. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
President Trump's America First rhetoric has been critical of international cooperation across the board. He called NATO obsolete and NAFTA the worst trade deal ever. And his administration announced plans last week to nominate a fierce critic of the International Monetary Fund to a key role at the Treasury Department. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports on what that could mean for international financial institutions in the years ahead.
President Trump wants a conservative economist named Adam Larrick to be the point man dealing with the IMF for the U.S. Treasury Department. Here's what Larrick had to say about the fund at a panel event a few years back.
I believe the fund has been a source of great instability and source of crises.
Larrick takes issue with the IMF's history of giving bailout loans to troubled countries like Greece and Portugal in 2010. Harvard economics professor Ken Rogoff says that's a common concern from conservative economists.
They feel that making these subsidized loans to countries at sub-market rates is exposing taxpayers to loss, and someday it could be a significant bill.
Still, Rogoff says,
while that's a valid point, the costs are not so great, and the IMF has been an incredible incredible instrument of power for the United States.
That's a lesson past presidents have learned. Just ask James Boughton, former IMF staff historian.
The very beginning of the first Reagan administration, the U.S. took a very negative view about the importance of the IMF, and then it changed very quickly.
When a major debt crisis hit Latin America and the U.S. banking system was under threat.
For the rest of his time in office, President Reagan became a very strong supporter of the IMF. I think it often starts off being ideological, and it ends up being practical.
Adam Larick's nomination would require Senate approval. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
The new U.S. Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, is a strong believer in school choice. But in rural communities across the country, there actually just aren't that many choices beyond public schools. And some people in those areas say that expanding school choice programs could put those existing rural schools at risk. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, Sam Whitehead reports.
Talbotton, Georgia is a small town of just about 1,000 people. But on a Saturday afternoon, the Central High School gym is packed. The Hawks boys basketball team is in the playoffs. Talbot County Schools Assistant Superintendent Cynthia Epps says it's kind of a big deal.
Cities like these, basketball games tends to be a gathering. Basketball game in churches.
Epps says the public school system is a vital part of this rural West Georgia community. It's one of the largest employers in Talbot County, where one quarter of the population lives in poverty. And there are no private or charter schools in the district, so it's the primary education option for most students, many of whom are African American.
It's a gateway to getting better. It's certainly a gateway here for families and children to be better, for children to be better.
But the district ranks among the worst in the state when it comes to student achievement. That's led parents like Shalonda Walker to look for other options. For years, she schlepped her kids to public schools with better academic rankings about 20 miles away in a neighboring county.
It was hectic, but it was worth it. I never complained because I was doing what was best for my kids.
State education money followed each of Walker's kids to that other district. Eventually, she brought them and that money home to Central High. Georgia pays at least $2,400 for each high school student enrolled in a district and will pay as much as $14,000 for those who need special services. Now, Walker's story is unusual in rural Talbotton. Most parents don't have the means to get their kids into public or private schools in neighboring districts. Republican State Representative Sam Teasley wants to make changing schools easier.
It is certainly my hope that where there are needs for students to be met, these parents are afforded more opportunities, more choices, so that their children can be in a school that fits their family's needs.
Teasley's trying to increase school choice by expanding a program that gives up to $2,500 in tax credits to couples who donate to private school scholarships. The proposal would increase the cap on those donations to $100 million a year from the state budget to help thousands of students go to private schools. The National Council of State Legislatures says 27 states have some kind of private school choice program on the books.
Choice sounds like a wonderful thing, except when it unfairly disadvantages a particular group or set of people.
Doris Williams studies education for the Rural School and Community Trust. She says money that goes to school choice programs often winds up reducing state school budgets, which means less money for rural public schools. Choice programs also pull students from rural districts, which hurts their funding even more. Back at the Central High Hawks basketball game, Talbot County Schools Superintendent Jack Catrett worries expanding school choice will widen the gap between haves and have-nots.
And it might not be based on race. It might be based on social economics, where it gets back to just poor folks having less and rich folk getting more.
But Catrett's working to keep that from happening. That starts by getting people to see his small, struggling rural district like he does as a good school choice. In Talbotton, Georgia, I'm Sam Whitehead for Marketplace.
Retail is in some trouble, you may have heard, and stores that rely on people coming into physical locations to shop for clothes are especially hurting. Macy's, Abercrombie & Fitch, the Limited, American Apparel, just a few retailers that have been closing stores recently. One reason, of course, is online shopping, but it's not always easy to buy clothes online. So companies are turning to technology to make shopping better and more futuristic. Two of those companies recently partnered up to use new virtual and augmented reality technology combined with a virtual map of your actual body to let you try on clothes in the digital world. That could happen either in stores or even at home. Bold Metrics is one of the companies involved. Co-founder and COO Morgan Linton told us how the tech will work. Morgan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start at the top with the easy stuff. What does Bold Metrics do?
Yeah, so at Bold Metrics, we've built an AI technology built upon one of the largest data warehouses of human body measurements, which means we can ask some very simple questions for consumers, things like their height, their weight, their age, their shoe size. And if they can answer those questions, we can actually predict over 90 body measurements at literally a higher level of accuracy than you could probably measure yourself.
And where does all that data come from, like TSA scanners?
No, you know, I wish we could get that data. And a lot of people have said, you should get data from the TSA. Something tells me they may not be the most interested in sharing that data with us. So we're partnering with private companies that have body scanners in gyms or in shopping malls, research institutions that actually run very large representative studies in particular countries. So we have actually like geographic body distributions for North America and Europe and other parts of the world. But then once you get the data, you have to align it. So we actually have three PhD data scientists on our team that work to take that data in, align the data sets together to be able to feed into the ML algorithms we have.
And then tell us about this new partnership then with Morph 3D and how you're
using
really
excited about this. So they can make very realistic humanoid avatars. You know, if you have an avatar that you create, a shopper or a consumer that's using our technology can literally just answer our standard question set. And it instantly generates an avatar that's a true-to-life avatar. So then if you see clothing on that avatar, if that avatar is sitting on a couch or sitting in a car or trying a golf club, all those will be to scale. So you could actually buy things in AR or VR.
And so, I don't know how old you are, but I grew up with a show called Gem and the Holograms, where she basically just had an infinite holographic closet. And when I hear you talk, that's what I'm thinking, and I'm stoked. Is this my Gem and the Holograms, like, this is my closet come to life?
Yes. You know, that future, which seemed so far off, really is getting incredibly close right now. The technology has come very far in the last 3 to 5 years. And, you know, we see a world where you'll be able to sit in your living room and try on 20 or 30 different outfits and then literally speak to a HoloLens or a similar AR device and say, buy this outfit. And the next day it could show up at your doorstep without ever looking at a size chart or having to wonder, hey, what size am I in this?
But so talk about the barriers to adoption for commerce. I mean, for one thing, you'd have to get stores to adopt the technology top to bottom, right? Which sounds non-trivial. Or you'd have to get consumers to all have a HoloLens. It sounds like, although I'm excited about my job in the holograms closet, it actually doesn't sound that close.
Yeah. So, no, it's a very good point. So we're definitely not there yet. These are the early days, and the solutions we're providing are going to be used in store. So that shoppers can come in and try on. You know, if you think about it, if you were to go to, say, a large apparel store or a large furniture store and you wanted to try, you know, 20 or 30 different outfits or 20 or 30 different couches, that's a time-consuming thing. In an augmented reality world, you can do that in 3 or 4 minutes, but it has to all be set up in the store. And right now it is very new, very much in kind of its early stages. But for consumer adoption, it's probably going to come once these are shipping with the smartphones themselves.
All right, Morgan, I'm waiting for my holographic closet. Morgan Linton is co-founder and COO of Bold Metrics. Thank you so much.
Getting closer by the day. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
This final note before we go, despite a generally down day on the market, gold prices were way up. Maybe it was that favorable market that spurred thieves in Berlin to make off with a Canadian gold coin worth about $4 million. And I say make off with, Like that was some easy job, but the coin actually weighs 221 pounds. And officials at the Berlin Museum say they believe the thief or thieves used a ladder to break into the museum, steal the coin, which is just under 2 feet wide, and somehow get it back down the ladder and escape. The theft is a huge loss for the Bode Museum in Berlin and for the Royal Canadian Mint, which issued the gold coin in 2007. It's actually featured in the Guinness Book of World Records for its purity. Still, though, really strong thieves. All right, we got to go. Wall Street's happy to have today behind them. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shed 45 points, 0.2% to close at 20,550. The NASDAQ gained 11 points, 0.2% to finish at 5840. And the S&P 500 fell 2 points, 0.1% to close at 2341. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I am Molly Wood, and we'll be back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.